Abolitionist for Everybody is a podcast that tackles the sometimes difficult conversations around prison abolition. I'm Crystal.
I'm Ra.
And I'm Adam.
In this season of Abolitionist for Everybody, we talk about harm.
What creates it, what recycles it, and how we can find our way to meaningful means of repair.
Just a reminder, friends, in this episode and every episode, we dive into very sensitive issues. This season is frameworked around violence. And though the title of this episode may give you some warning, remember that harm itself tends to create situations of alternate harms. There will probably be other painful topics brought up too. Take care of you.
The following recording is one of Initiate Justice's incarcerated members sharing their story.
Their name and the location where they are incarcerated have been removed to maintain their safety.
I have been down for 9 going on 10 years, and I've done my base term of 8 years, and I'm working on my 10-year gun and hat from the time now. I came back from Afghanistan in 2011. I was 23 years old. It was my second deployment overseas. I came back in 2011, and I had a lot of issues coming back. I was later diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and major depressive disorder. There was just a lot I was contending with at the time, and within 24 hours of coming back, I started using drugs to try to self-medicate myself. I started hanging around with the wrong people, and a combination of the drug use and my just terrible self-destructive behaviors and habits and ways of thinking, I started robbing people to support my habit. I got arrested in September of 2011 for 2 different robberies. I got sentenced to 18 years in prison, and as I mentioned, I'm working on enhancement time now, but in the time since I've been down, I've been clean for 8 years. I have completely changed as a person. It's hard for me to look back, and it's hard for me to look back and actually accept that it was me that did the terrible things that I did. It seems like a dream. It seems like a different lifetime almost. And I know there's no amount of remorse that could ever change what I did, or I can never go back and fix things, but
this call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
In the meantime, since I've been down, I've been working really hard. I've been going to just about every single self-help group you could think of, probably some that you haven't even heard of. I have educated myself. I've earned 2 associate's degrees. I'm working on a third. I'm halfway done with my paralegal certificate, and I'm working on my certificate to become a drug and alcohol counselor. I've been engaged in the civic process through Initiate Justice. I've been a member of Underground Scholars through UC Berkeley, and in 2020 I was accepted into UC Berkeley. I deferred my enrollment until 2022. I hope to be out by then. If I were able to get resentenced and not have to do this gun enhancement time, I would be able to immediately parole to UC Berkeley and get my bachelor's degree in social welfare. And armed with that education, I could return to my community and build where I once destroyed, which is all that I've wanted to do ever since I got arrested and ended up in prison and looked around me and saw what I bought with my life. There's no way to fully express the remorse. I look around right now at where I'm at, and it's this same scene that I had seen for the last 10 years. And it's sad and it's heartbreaking, and I want to be a part of the solution, and I want more than anything to be a good citizen and to get out and try to change everything that leads up to all this. I look around me and it's sad to see the kids that are coming in that were my age when I got busted, and they're doing the same things, but they haven't woken up yet, and they haven't realized the path that they're on. It's become my passion and my purpose in life to try to do something about this problem that I was once a part of. And I think I'm in a unique situation where I was able to come out of it. I'm able to use the experiential knowledge I've gained.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I'm able to use the experiential knowledge I've gained walking out this path in prison and seeing it from this side. I'll be able to use it with my formal education at Berkeley. And with those two things, I know I can do a lot of good, not just individually, but I know I can bring a lot to communities everywhere, not just where I'm from. And I can contribute a lot to organizations like Initiate Justice, Underground Scholars, and Success Stories. I can help, and that's all that I want to do. And I'm doing the best I can while I'm still in here. I keep taking a day at a time and working on myself a day at a time and working towards getting out a day at a time. One day I will get out and I'll do all of these things, whether I get resentenced or not, whether my gun enhancement gets removed or not. It's not a matter of me not doing it, because I will. It's just a matter of when. I sincerely hope that it's sooner rather than later.
Collective silence, and I can feel and hear my heart pounding in my ears right now, because there's just so much emotion to that. You can hear it in his voice, and you know, as someone who has a brother who is incarcerated and gets those phone calls, I'm feeling so many emotions right now. What are you both feeling?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I too feel a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions is coming up. Just hearing his story and hearing him talk about what he's been through, you know, coming out of the service and being diagnosed with PTSD and the lack of help, right, to led up to him doing drugs, right, and then committing robberies and making this transition. And as a person that is formerly incarcerated, as a person that it has been through the hardships of transitioning, right, working on AAs and going to different self-help groups. It was just a lot of emotion that came up for me. And something that stuck out the most that I love is what he said, when he said, whether they let him out early or not, he's still going to continue to do the work. And that just was like, that was like the rose, you know? So flowers to him for sharing.
Absolutely. I think, like everyone else, I think I was just kind of listening in silence and processing it all. There are so many, you know, this is another episode about harm. This one focuses on gun violence. But I thought it was interesting to see the trajectory of how easy the escalation into violence is, and how difficult and so he has to self-lead it into the de-escalation in his own life, and how much effort has gone into that for him, despite prison,
right,
I should say.
And not to mention that he was 23 when he came back from Afghanistan and dealing with PTSD and depression.
Right. None of that stuff is also treated inside. In fact, very often the medical like drugs that you're able to have out here that might mitigate some of the symptoms aren't even available inside, because they're either narcotics or like sisters to them. And so they eliminate all those things. There's also a an overlay of like, as someone who's dealt with an addiction, whether or not you want to seek help from these pills, you know?
But to take us back a little bit, Roz, you know, you're talking and saying how none of that is available inside. None of that was available outside either. He talks about coming back and having depression and PTSD and, you know, substance abuse and trying to figure out life as a 23-year-old, you know, who just came back. And I'm sure the things he experienced in Afghanistan and, you know, as a service member, coming back and not having anywhere to turn.
Right.
Because he mentions that he knew that something was wrong and that he needed help, yet he had nowhere to turn to.
Sometimes people don't understand how brave it is to go back into the situations, or being willing to go back into the situations that caused you so much harm. Because as much as, like, in his storytelling, he was talking about the harm he caused, that was a lot of failure on the part of systems that should have backed him up at every stage. We have programs.
Right.
Yeah, we have programs for vets. We have programs for people struggling with addiction, and they aren't serving the needs because oftentimes it's because they're underfunded, which is frustrating when we think about it in this, like, context of him being a vet, which is obviously an overfunded
and project. That's where I want to chime in right there is with him coming out of the service, right, giving his all to a country that have the resources but somehow don't provide the right resources, especially to someone that's young coming out of, I'm sure, witnessing and being introduced to a whole nother level of violence in itself. Right. Fighting for our country.
Specifically gun violence.
Right.
You know, it's no surprise that a country that puts so much money into military and general imperialism has has a problem managing gun violence. And right now our solutions in place, and please define these better for me, Crystal or Adam, but he talked very briefly about, he said, serving his base sentence and still having more time to do. And I know both of you are better versed on sentence enhancement. So if y'all want to take it and explain, because I'm not sure if every listener would really understand what that means.
Right. So a base term is the term or the sentence that you are given for your original crime, whereas an enhancement, it's something that gets added to your base term. So for this member, for example, said that they're almost done with their base term. They're on 9 years going on their 10th, and then they got added a gun enhancement. So once he's done with his, you know, base term, he starts year one of that 10-year gun enhancement.
Right. That's exactly what it is, Crystal. You explained it perfectly. And that's the same situation that happened with me. I was charged for manslaughter, accessory to manslaughter, and I had to serve 10 years. And after that 10 years, I had to serve an additional 11 years for the gang enhancement. Excuse me, I had to serve 11 years for the manslaughter and 10 years for the gang enhancement.
Wow, that's almost double.
Right, right.
Did you know about enhancements before going in?
Didn't know nothing about enhancements, right? The attorney that I had, he never explained to me. You know, it wasn't anything, because before I had went to trial, right? And when I went to trial, I got a deadlock, meaning they couldn't come up with a decision stating if I was guilty or not guilty. It was just kind of like a split decision. So that's later on, that's when they offered me a plea bargain, which was 21 years. And, you know, they made it sound so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, I don't want to get life. So I took the deal. And later on, I understood, like, oh, so I got to do my 11 years first. And then I have to do, you know, my additional 10 years for being a gang member, a former gang member.
Thank you for explaining that, because I think there's, like, lots of gaps for people when they hear about this. So my question was, to me, kind of like a trick question. I know nobody knew about enhancements before coming in. When I was down, I consistently ran into people who didn't know what those were. And myself, while helping them through their paperwork, I had no understanding of what that was either. And it wasn't super accessible information. At that point in my prison journey, my husband was still alive and still very active in my life. So I was able to call him and get information from, like, the internet. But I remember that he even had trouble with that, because it's really not, it's not super available information that explains the dynamics of it. And I'm bringing up all of this because enhancements are often sold as a preventative measure. And if no one even knows they exist, how does that work, you know?
You know, and the thing, Raw, that as I'm hearing this individual talk, the unfortunate thing and the thing that always hurts my heart is that it's a very common story. You know, in California alone, there are 30,000 people who are incarcerated who have a gun enhancement, and 90% of those people are people of color. And, you know, most of those people don't know that these enhancements existed. So oftentimes, and gun enhancements are just one type of enhancements that exist. And oftentimes they are sold as something that keeps us safe.
They do. And it's very, very troubling to see how many people have gotten so many different type of gun enhancements. I've seen other people that have had gun enhancements similar to our Initiate Justice member that we just heard, where it was from 10 years, some have got 5 years, some even have gotten 25 to life. And gun enhancements doesn't stop gun violence. So it's a deeper problem that we have to address.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot with like all the carceral issues, is how does removing someone from the scenario stop this in communities, stop the things that created it to begin with? Yeah, it really doesn't. And silence isn't an apology, which is why he's so active in this work to rectify it in different ways. Because what is a meaningful apology is learning the skills that would have helped you, and then being so brave or generous as to go backwards and offer those communities where you came from. And that, to me, strikes me as a very real and reasonable level of accountability that we could implement if we weren't just locking people up.
Yeah, for sure. It's accountability and the ability to help others, right? Because of his experience and what he has learned. I'm just so amazed to know that he has been accepted to Berkeley, but decided to, you know, say, hey, I need to finish what I'm doing right now and be able to attend Berkeley, UC Berkeley, when he come home, and going for a bachelor's art in social welfare. It really helps the problem, right? People say, well, we have to find a solution. And that helps, to me, that helps it because he has personal experience, what was lacking and what needs to be done. And even more, he's taken initiative to learn more, to be able to give back to returning citizens that's coming back from services that so many times get overlooked, but yet is diagnosed with PTSD and there's no help being provided.
You know, I want to touch on something that Ra mentioned earlier, and, you know, the systems of desperation that we have now. Part of my role here is reading hundreds, if not thousands, of letters that come from incarcerated individuals. And there's this one letter that I read almost a year ago, I would say, and I still think about as sometimes as I'm doing the work. And that is of an individual who was sharing his experience with gun enhancements. And he mentioned how he was homeless and had, you know, substance abuse problems, and how he was feeling hungry. So he went to the store to grab something to eat. And he was high at that time. And as he was leaving, he noticed that a cop car started following him. So he started to panic and he started walking faster down the alley. And that walk turned into a run. And the police started, you know, following him. And he panicked. He pulled out a gun and shot into the air. And with that, he got a 25 to life sentence. You know, enhancements can go that high. And I read the desperation, and I felt the desperation. I felt the pain as he was writing that. And he says, after being incarcerated for many, many years, such as, you know, what we just heard, is like the remorse. One thing that he mentioned often was like the remorse, and that he needed help. And one thing that we often don't talk about is, as long as we have these systems where people are desperate for survival, desperate because they don't have the resources that we need, instances like this ones will keep happening. And, you know, our member and, you know, the person who wrote to me, you know, had all of these thoughts and emotions, and, you know, this member is going to Berkeley, and that wasn't because of prison. You know, we're spending, I believe it's like $100,000 a year, $1 million for that 10 10-year enhancement where he can be out here going to Berkeley, one of the top, you know, universities in the world. So I often think about that story. Whenever gun enhancements come up, I always remember that letter that I read.
It's very, very like, it's not welcoming, but it's for sure welcoming to the empathy that we have to others, right? Knowing that I have a couple friends of mine that are doing time from a gun enhancement, that's doing time off a gang enhancement, but specifically speaking about gun enhancements and gun violence and how it's usually something that leads up to that, right? And in this case, we definitely see that he came from the service, right? So he was used to being around artillery, right? Have PTSD, and now he start using drugs, and he has access to guns, and he's now acting under impulse because of being under the influence, right? Making sporadic decisions. But let's just say if he would have had the help and had the resources and had somebody to reach out to, then that one sporadic night of using drugs and going out to commit a robbery, right? Promoting gun violence, right?
Right.
Then that wouldn't happen, you know?
Yeah, it absolutely is one of the biggest enhancements. And I was really struck by the use of the word access. You said like he had access to guns. And I think that's such an important thing because a lot of what we talk about here is stuff that we do not have access to. You know, he didn't have access to PTSD medication. He didn't have access to mental health care. And that $1 million that I think Crystal mentioned, you know, 10 years of incarceration for him costs us $1 million. And how much treatment could we be providing to the communities he came from for that dollar amount, you know? And another thing I wanted to briefly highlight, but Adam, you might have more thoughts on this particularly, is that, you know, Crystal said that Berkeley was happening like despite prison. And I know that learning inside is a struggle. So it out here, when you say like, oh, someone got an AA, that's cool. And that's a lot of work. And I totally commend everybody who, every one of those achievements is incredible. But when you're inside and you have to continually fight to even be allowed outside your cell to access the library and the computer is locked down and you are constantly fighting for that education, it's a different experience. It's a lot of work, and it really indicates when you think about it being the most common enhancement and how many people are in there for gun violence because they had access to that when they didn't have access to other things. And then on top of that, how strongly they fight for their own rehabilitation when we don't.
Right, right. And to really broaden the picture, right? I'm gonna use something that I learned when I was in college, was the second shift, pertaining to women that actually go out and work and then having to come home and take care of the household, cooking, cleaning, taking care of the kids, right? And still have to deal with the distractions and different things. So a person that's inside going to get their AA, right, going to self-help groups, staying away from the gun, from the gang violence, staying away from the drugs, right? Things that we have been used to, we step away from that and we take on the role of the second shift because you have so much to do at hand. And that's so amazing that he can be able to say, hey, I'm gonna step away from all this and I'm gonna be able to have all these responsibilities, right? And be able to be successful. That is going to be the key things to help change and move to going away with gun enhancements, right? And understanding how gun violence is happening from similar situations to people that's coming home from, whether it's from the army, from the service, or coming home from being incarcerated before, or having different growing up in a environment where this is okay, where this is accepted, and being able to go back into those communities and say, hey, you know, we do have help and I can help you. And I'm not just going to point you to someone that has no experience, but being able to say, hey, we can get help from people that actually have experience.
Yeah, I agree. That's 100% true. And like education in these communities in regards to what they need, like our education in regards to what those communities need. What can we provide access to in a significant enough supply that it overwhelms the accessibility of guns? You know, I'm half South Asian American, half Mexican, fully both. And I think I would feel I would feel a way if I left this gun conversation without mentioning what's been happening in the United States over the last few years, which is a rise in hate crimes. And oftentimes these cases are used as an argument for these enhancements. But I want to just really drill home everything we've said here, which is that enhancements do not keep us safe. Enhancements cannot prevent crime. And it's important to remember that we have this model of gun violence in this country that we have to address, particularly. And right now, I know there's probably not many, but I am talking to, you know, the 4 South Asian listeners. we here, you know, we are of people who have come from people who have seen what gun violence and military violence can do to a country. And if there are no consequences for cops, if there are no consequences for military, if they are some of the biggest perpetrators of gun violence in this country, and they are, then why are we going after the young men? It's very often young men who are being, you know, kind of thrown under the bus, under the banner of this. And it really falls on us to find some kind of equity that keeps us safe. And it is not this.
And we're always looking at, you know, the individual. And the media has such a way of making these stories out to be really, really big, you know, and gun enhancements have been around since the 1990s. So that's more than 20 years of these gun enhancements existing and just like locking people up, you know, a large contributor to the mass incarceration here in California. And we never talk about the systemic issues that are in place. We never talk about getting these guns off the streets. We never talk about helping Black and Brown communities that are always experiencing this. And, you know, most of the folks that are locked up because of this are people of color, and oftentimes young, like our member, 23 years old, you know, and they're
so young.
So young. One thing that I often think about is these systemic issues that are happening, you know, before, and that's not to mention everything that he is going through while incarcerated and all of his beautiful achievements,
right?
Despite prison, mm-hmm. despite the trauma that he has being incarcerated, it's like looking even before that happened and just imagining the folks since the 90s that had to do this time because of the gun enhancements. And, you know, the gun violence that we experience from the cops.
Yeah.
That is something that, you know, Ra mentioned earlier in the season that in 2021, there is only 15 days where the police didn't kill somebody. And I'm not saying that, you know, all of those days were from a gun, but that is something that we never talk about. We see in the news often how guns are used in Black and Brown communities. And we've talked about, you know, the lack of resources and desperation, but we never talk about the violence that comes from the police. I know one of the first experiences that I had was when my older brother was first incarcerated back when I was in high school. And I remember the big guns they were carrying and they were pointed at us as they were coming through the alley, you know, dressed in like normal clothing. And my younger sister was actually the first one who saw them coming because she was in the kitchen. And over a decade, this happened in like 2008 or so. So, you know, a long time ago, and sometimes the door in our backyard slams and I still see my whole family just like, you know, have a reaction to it because it takes them back to the time where the police officers were pointing their guns at us and, you know, they came in threatening us. And I remember they had us all in the living room for like hours with you know, my dad and my brother handcuffed. And at some point, my mom moved from one couch to the other because she has some health issues and she needed some air. And right away, the cop was like, you know, he put his hand on his gun and he's like, don't do that, accidents happen. And my brother was like, oh, she's sick. She just wanted to sit in front of the AC. He's like, well, he's like, that's how accidents happen. Don't do that again. So I think that was my first experience with guns and gun violence that came from the cops.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. And it's just so saddening to hear, you know, that he had the nerve to say not once, but several times, accidents happen. So right. Basically, you're already justifying what you're getting ready to do because you have intentions on doing that. And I agree, you know, one of my first times witnessing, you know, gun violence, was coming out of a community where it was gang induced, right? But it came specifically from an officer himself. And we was young, you know, I was young and a couple of guys, you know, we shooting dice, shooting craps in high school, and everybody started running. So I don't know what's going on, right? Because I'm so involved in this dice game. And when I turn around, I see a barrel pointed at the back of my head, and I was so scared. And he kept telling me, don't move, don't move. And all I could remember was like, okay, what's going on? And that really like haunted me for years to come. And that kind of, that made me want to stay away from getting the help from, you know, from officers, right? And even years later, going into prison and like saying, hey, I'm cool, because it's still that image that we see. So I feel like we're living in times where we all can change the narrative. And if I may, I want to go back to the scenario with the second shift, right? I feel like we are living in times now where the second shift shouldn't just be solely on women. We all can help out, right? In my household, I can help out and fold clothes and help clean. And I feel like that's the same with what's taking place in today's society, especially with our loved one being inside and is helping out with what he's doing to better himself, but getting everybody else involved, so we can continue to change the narrative based on the times that we're living in, because we have that voice and we actually can create the resources, or can be able to have connections to get the resources.
Yeah, absolutely. The narrative is super important when it comes to carceral issues like this. There's an organization called Culture Shift, and they like to say that a story is a star and a narrative is the constellation. And it's super important that we keep producing these stars, you know, sharing our stories so that we can shift the storytelling elements behind these, because guns are so glorified in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to remember that we all contribute a little bit to these violences. You know, we contribute by watching these movies, sanctioning them. All the heroes have guns, and there are scenarios in movies and TV shows where guns come out and people just kind of function normally. But having been in spaces that are heavy in guns, that's not really how things work. Guns are violent structures. Right. And none of these things are solved by the negative storytelling we're telling, or making it cool, or because even mentally giving it access is a thing. Like, even if you make a service available, you have to make the people who the service is available for understand, as we talked about, you know, we talk about this all the time, you know, because it's that's part of the work too, is giving them the opportunities to actually access these things. And with guns, we meet those needs. We make the product accessible and we make the mentality accessible. And right. We even have state sanctioned versions of it that we can see examples of, and they're exemplified, you know, in every scenario. So that's super important. Like, this is, you know, we talk a lot about what are the tiny things we can do. It's like, change how you see these things, change how you talk about these things. Don't be like, oh,
change the narrative.
Yeah, change the narrative. Put your story up there in the sky, you know?
Right.
I'm curious, with both of you, what is your experience with, you know, gun violence and being formerly incarcerated? I know, as someone who goes to the jails and the prisons to visit my brother, that is something that I really, really don't like walking through the metal detector and all the COs and seeing the guns that they have, like, super quickly available if anything were to happen. What do you all experience when it comes to that and being in prison?
It would take a whole nother season, right? To sum up some of the things that Ra and I have saw. Yeah. I think, for me personally, being on a high security, right? I was on a high security level. I was on a level 4 starting off. And so, to put it in terms, level 4 is like maximum security. You don't have too much movement. You only have a certain amount of time out of your cell, right? At that time, it was like an hour and a half. And every 2 days, we would get day room. But the gun violence that I have witnessed there, I have seen people actually get shot. I have seen people that have gotten shot and have been in wheelchairs, right? I have seen gun violence on a whole nother level, to the point where, okay, we're not going to use real guns and real ammunition only if they have a weapon, but we're still going to use something that is a gun, which is called a block gun, which is pieces of wood that they shoot to stop people from fighting, right? And if that don't work, then we have another type of gun that shoots out rubber bullets. So I have actually seen it like firsthand. I've actually had to lay flat on the yard because it's a riot that's taking place. And, you know, you can see stuff ricocheting and you trying to roll and kind of get out of the way because you don't want to be a casualty, as they say. So I have seen it from the worst of the worst because I started off at a level 4. However, when I went down from level 4 to level 3 to level 1 because of good behavior and the way I was conducting myself as a person mm-hmm. that was incarcerated, I wasn't around as much gun violence.
Mm. I'm just going to sound super naive, but in those same experiences, like a couple things. My thought when I walked in to jail and saw all the guns everywhere was that expression, like if the only tool you have is a hammer, you know, or if the only tool you have, that becomes your hammer, that type of thing. And it's the only tool they have, you know, so that was something I was like immediately aware of, you know, they didn't have, there's no timeout corner or things like that. Like the only thing they can do is escalate it to restricting what little freedom you have, locking you back in. And using their gun. Those are pretty much the only two things. And that's a scenario that can lead to a lot of escalated and continuous trauma, which is the root cause of PTSD. So it's particularly rough on people who came in with PTSD. But for myself, I remember one of the first things being told was that if they shot me with a rubber bullet, I would be charged for the rubber bullet. And because that was an expense to the state. And
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Charged like financially?
Yeah, like financially charged. So not only would I be shot with this bullet, but that it would go on my books, which was just...
I'm going to shoot you and make you pay for it. Yeah.
And then there was a small fight on our yard. It sounds ridiculous, but it was literally two women fighting about sheets, like for the bed type of thing. So it was mm-hmm. tiny, but it escalated into a really loud volume fight and they shut it entirely down. It was nighttime. We were outside. I was face down on grass. One of the women I was incarcerated with was fundamentally stronger than me as a human being. And she kind of like pushed me up against the wall and sat in front of me so I would be safe. And there were just like shots everywhere. And you could just see the light and the shot. It honestly felt like being in battle. And that felt like a ridiculous thought because I'm like, I'm a programmer at that time in my life. But it really felt like wartime. You know, even us just like huddled in the corner waiting for it to pass and hoping we weren't a casualty.
Right. And you're saying wartime, you know, thinking of our member, he literally just came back from being in the war
and then
getting into prison, into, you know, an environment like this. And not to mention that society has created this illusion for young men that, you know, guns are somehow like, you know, like, you know, it takes you to adulthood and, you know, maturity, feeding into our patriarchy and toxic masculinity.
Right.
And, you know, having to change the attitudes around mm-hmm. guns, you know, and, you know, changing gun violence. And I know that this was probably a heavy episode for our listeners. I know my heart still feels heavy with the recording that we listened to. So I know a lot of folks out there are experiencing the same thing. So, you know, to end this with a little bit of hope, what do you all want to say to our listeners?
I guess my tiny tangible thing you could do today is just really pay attention to the stories you hear about guns and the stories you're not hearing about guns, about people whose lives mm-hmm. were just erased from our social spectrum as if that solved anything for anybody. I honestly think just watching these like TV shows and using our language carefully and just engaging carefully with this information will significantly change what we're doing.
Ra, I like your tiny tangible action because that was my tiny tangible action as well. Paying attention to the experiences of folks directly impacted. You know, there's 40,000 people inside right now with gun enhancements.
Wow.
This has been around since the 1990s. And like our member shared, all of the different circumstances that led to the situation where he was in, and in that moment 10 years of his life are going to be in prison because of these gun enhancements.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. I would say being able to have the courage to change the narrative is very, very important, and it helps out. And once again, our member is doing that, right? He is been able, he's in a situation where he's having to manage a lot, but he's still giving his all to help change what's taking place and changing the narrative and doing so. And I think that's a little bit of hope that I can share with mm-hmm. share with our listeners is, you know, utilize your voice, you know, be able to help out if you can, be able to bring awareness, because there's people out there that will support you on that and take the initiative. And it's okay to feel that, you know, should I be speaking up on this or should I be addressing this? No, addressing gun violence is something that we all need to address, because at any given time, it can be one of our loved ones. That's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Let's have more students walking around Berkeley than being inside those walls.
Well said.
This isn't the full story of the full humans involved in these experiences, or every complete community or person who has gone through experiences that parallel. We have walked this gently so as not to diminish the story, but to highlight and amplify the hearts involved.
Thank you for listening to Abolitionist for Everybody. If you want to continue supporting this podcast and our work overall, you can donate to support Initiate Justice at initiatejustice.org/donate.